Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. I have the tall chair in the studio today. It just worked out that way. No one was trying to discriminate against any of my co-hosts, but it turns out somebody got a short chair and they seem to be whining about it.
I think mine's the tallest.
You certainly have a competitively tall chair, Shelley. I'd have to say that. So anybody else want to weigh in on the chairs?
You are lucky. There is a person between me and you.
This is the It's Trump and Bevin in 2017 show. That's right. In the words of Garrison Keillor, 2004, we're all Republicans, all Republicans, all Republicans now. The Garrison Keillor, very prophetic song that he put on Prairie Home Companion, and in fact, it is true. Thanks to our listeners of True Talk Internet Radio, and I am now introducing my co-medical hosts who've already weighed in on their relative chair heights from the University of Kentucky, Assistant Professor in the Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And to explain to you about our web presence, from down in his chair, the Manager of Communications Infrastructure for UK, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. Moorhead State Public Radio does have a website. I'm sure you've been there. If not, you should visit it. There's a little menu there. Look at the MSPR programs, and you'll find Health Matters. Jump over to that page. You'll see a list of the most recent shows. Got a little summary there for each show. There's a link to the audio for the show. We encourage you to go out and listen to the show. Maybe you caught a partial. Maybe you want to hear it again. Maybe, I don't know, maybe you're just crazy.
Bored?
Crazy? Something like that? Anyway, we put the audio link out there for your listening pleasure. Send it out to your friends. Let them know that you are a Health Matters listener and bring them into the fold. After that, jump over to Facebook.com/HM Radio Show. There you will find the fan page for Health Matters. That's right. We have a fan page. Isn't that right, Tony?
Absolutely.
And that was all your idea, wasn't it? You came up with the whole idea of calling it a fan page.
Well, I thought we ought to get on, what is it, Snapbook? FaceTime?
Insta-snap. Insta-snap. So, Facebook.com/HM Radio Show, that's where you'll find Health Matters. Interact with us, ask us questions, leave us feedback, suggest show topics. Maybe there's something you just need some clarification on. Maybe you just want to make fun of Tony. There is no telling why you would go there, but certainly go there and interact with the show. Again, you'll be amazed. We do respond. We put things up there that are on the show, that are in the news, that are just funny, that sometimes are serious, but don't hold us to that. Again, interact with the show, Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Hypertension Guidelines from the American College of Physicians and the American Academy of Family
Boy,
Physicians.
Boy, you were really creative on that sponsor.
Hang on. I've got poetry.
From up there.
I have verse.
From where? Way up there.
When you treat your high BP, remember these guidelines three. There are three tips from the American College of Physicians.
Okay, these, Mr. Shakespeare.
These are large primary care organizations. They are not composed primarily of cardiologists. So they have made some practical recommendations for treating high blood pressure. And I will tell you, these came out January 17th. They are already under fire. I've already seen comments publicly indicating that perhaps they are not accurate or not to be used universally. We'll talk more about that. But here on January 17th, here's what they said. They released an evidence-based guideline. Evidence-based meaning they reviewed the research literature. This is not expert opinion or in our experience. It is looking at the literature. This is specifically for adults age 60 years or older for treatment of high blood pressure. And they recommend a less aggressive treatment target. This is the same thing that the Joint National Committee, the JNC 8 guidelines recommended. We back down on our level of aggressiveness because when we look at the evidence, there is not the strong evidence for treating aggressively. Now, contrary to that, there are cardiology groups who feel that there was one study published, a controversial study, indicating that we treat as aggressively as we possibly can and we get better outcomes. There is still a substantial amount of disagreement about where we ought to go with our targets. The exciting thing is we're starting to get some evidence together, and I think we will be better at treating high blood pressure going forward. Systematic review of 21 randomized controls trials. That's the best science you can get, where you put half the people in one treatment group, half the people in another treatment group, and you compare the outcomes. But they also did three observational studies. That's where we look at treatments that are already underway, and we see whether or not they seem to be working well. Not quite as good, because there might be other things that influence the initial choice of treatment, but still, those are decent studies. They looked at harms, major cardiac events, heart attacks, fatal heart attacks, sudden cardiac death, and here's what they said. First of all, in people over age 60, you should start treating if their blood pressure gets above 150 on the top number. Now, we've used the number 140 over 90, top number being 140, but they say you should start treatment in people over age 60 if the blood pressure gets above 150. Second thing they said, if you have somebody who has a history of stroke, then you should try to achieve a target blood pressure of less than 140 to lessen the risk of stroke. And we do this in pretty much everybody. We try to reach that target of 140 or less. And they say, especially in people with stroke, it's important. If we have to go to two medicines or three medicines, get that top number down below 140. And then the third one, consider initiating or intensifying treatment in older patients at high cardiac risk to reach the blood pressure less than 140. Now, these are not exciting, groundbreaking new guidelines. Treat when it's over 150. If you're looking at people at high risk of stroke or evidence of a high risk of heart disease, get to below 140. One thing that really interested me on this, actually, is recommendations for the bottom number were not made. We usually say, well, if it's above 90, treat to get it below 90. But they said there really is not enough evidence to make a recommendation on the bottom number. I am, Shelley,
we have a problem with things sitting low? It took you that long to get that?
No, it took me that long to realize that you can't let the chair height go. That I took blood pressure guidelines here, treating above 150 to get it below 140, and you decided somehow I was making fun of your chair.
You are. You don't seem to care about the low number.
Neither does the American College of Physicians or the American Association of Family Physicians or the vast majority of our listeners.
I still think my low number's highest.
You guys are bad.
Yeah, you. If your low number ever got as high as Shelley's low number, you should probably have treatment.
Yeah.
But back to blood pressure.
I don't really like it when you two gang up on me.
I'm enjoying this. See, Shelley's in between us in a lofty position.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's our sponsor, Hypertension Guidelines. When you treat your high BP, remember these guidelines three. Rick, how about we talk about earwax?
You can go ahead. Have at it.
Okay. First of all, the American Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery Foundation released a new set of guidelines. Much of these are technical things for physicians, but there were some interesting sidelights, and I thought we should mention them. First of all, Q-tips. An ear canal-shaped cotton swab perfectly designed to fit in your fingers and in your ear canals is, in fact, should not be placed in your ear.
You know why?
Yes, I do. Do you?
Yeah, because it says so right on the box.
It, in fact, does on the Q-tips box. You're absolutely right. It says do not place in ear. And yet, can I tell you, I am. This is full disclosure. This is me laying myself out there. I use Q-tips in my ears.
Who doesn't?
Are you shocked?
Who doesn't?
I use it after a shower to dry out my ears. I don't really use it to remove earwax.
Okay.
But I do put it in the ear canal, which is...
Do you even know if you have earwax?
Well, sure, the Q-tip comes out. Clean as a whistle.
Yeah. But so, this is where you guys just don't have enough fun in your life, right? I spent 16 years running around a hospital as a biomedical, you know, technician, engineer, call it whatever you want. So we got to play with all the good toys. And some of the best toys were the scopes, right?
Right.
The scopes that were designed to show you things in places that you weren't really normally going to see in a mirror. And so... And in my role in telemedicine director, I would constantly be showing off this gear because you used to have to take the video image and send it somewhere in telemedicine, right? So I constantly needed a demo patient to demonstrate how we would show an ear infection to a doctor from a school-age patient, you know, in the school. And so I demonstrated on myself many, many years. And I'm pretty sure that for a long time, you know, I'm pretty sure I don't have any earwax.
Now,
and I think I have people that will vouch for me on that.
I've got photos.
You have no idea.
Rick has the confirmatory video. But here's the thing.
You guys missed out, man. I got to check heart rate monitors. I mean, you know, we used to get to do all the cool toys.
You know too much about yourself.
I know what my low number is.
1-2000.
It's lower than mine.
Yes. 1-2013 study, more than 90% of participants at a medical center clean their ear canals with objects like Q-tips or matchsticks or something.
And there Matchsticks.
Matchsticks. Yeah, and there was a an ENT physician said that for construction workers, they would use nails. Gently. But they would use nails. I had a partner that used paper clips. He would bend the paper clip and then would make a. He would use the bent part of the paper clip to sort of scrape out his ear canal, I guess.
It wouldn't occur to me to put something like that in my ear.
Really?
Really.
Shelly, you've not lived. You've not felt pain. I really sympathize with you. The thing that these guidelines said, though, earwax is actually good for you to an extent. You do not want it to occlude your ear canal, but it prevents dirt, dust, and other small items, and that includes bugs that fly in from getting up next to your ear canal where they can cause intense pain and have to be removed. So a little bit of wax is not a problem, and occasionally there is too much wax. And they mentioned one of the problems with trying to remove wax with a Q-tip is a very effective tamping stick, and it actually tamps the wax up against the eardrum. And I have seen people who packed it in. I'm sure you have too, Shelley.
Yeah.
They were trying to get rid of it, and it was essentially rock hard. I have pulled basically a earwax plug out of an ear canal before, and that was not fun for me, nor was it fun for the person who had the earwax plug. We have come to appreciate that clinicians are not the only users of the guidelines, and so they put together their do's and don'ts of earwax. Now, I'm sure many of you have do's and don'ts of earwax, but the Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery Foundation has their do's and don'ts, and I'm going to go through them here because I've got about a minute left. First of all, know that earwax is normal. Earwax, if it does not cause symptoms, does not block the ear canal, you should leave it alone. The goal is not to get all the wax out of your ear. The second do understand symptoms of earwax impaction. That's where the wax blocks the ear. Decreased hearing, fullness, ringing in the ear, and distortion and changes in your hearing aid function. The next do, see your healthcare provider if you have symptoms of hearing loss, ear fullness, or ear pain, if you're not certain they're from earwax. There are other ear conditions that can mimic that. The next do ask your provider about ways you can treat your earwax impaction at home. There are some conditions which make some options unsafe. The big thing is if you have a hole in your eardrum, a perforated eardrum, when you put liquids in, those liquids are going to go straight through that hole in the eardrum to places that liquids should not go. Do seek medical attention if you have ear pain, drainage, or bleeding. These are not symptoms of earwax impaction. Bleeding from the ears is never good. Here's a don't. Don't overclean your ears, Rick. Too much cleaning may bother your ear canal and may even increase the chance of an impaction.
Huh?
Yeah. Don't put cotton swabs, hairpins, car keys, toothpicks, or other things in your ear. Don't do that. These can injure your ear, cause a cut in your ear canal, poke a hole in your eardrum. And what the interesting thing is, the skin gets more sensitive the closer you get to the actual eardrum. We got some more don'ts, but we're going to hold them for our second fractional portion. Let's take a break. You take a break. Throw the Q-tips away. What are you saving those Q-tips for anyway? We know what you're up to. We're going to take a break and come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the It's Trump and Bevin in 2017 show. We are announcing the fact that we're all Republicans. Whether or not we celebrate it will depend upon what the Republicans do, obviously. But we are acknowledging the fact that our state Senate, our state House of Representatives, and our state governor are Republican. Our national Senate, national House of Representatives, and our president are Republican. So, in effect, all aspects of our government right now are Republican.
It's easy for you to say from up there in your high chair.
It won't bother me up here. You may have some problems with it. Our sponsor for the second time, the high blood pressure guidelines from the American College of Physicians and the American Academy of Family Physicians. When you treat your high BP, remember these guidelines three. There are three things that they mentioned that we thought were worth bringing onto this show. Again, there has been a debate. There are some research studies that indicate people with chronic illnesses or elderly people should be treated more aggressively and they have good outcomes. The problem is when you do research, you select people who tend to be healthier and have fewer additional diseases and conditions. And so there is another group of people who feel that that research cannot be applied more generally because of the artificial conditions of the research. So on the one camp, people who have scientific evidence that treating aggressively high blood pressure in elderly patients works. On the other camp, people that do not feel that that evidence was obtained in such a way that made it relevant for practice. Here are the guidelines from the American College of Physicians, American Academy of Family Physicians. Number one, you start treatment in older patients with persistent blood pressure top number at or above 150. Number two, you initiate or intensify treatment in older patients with a history of stroke to reach a target blood pressure of less than 140 because that lowers their risk of having another stroke. And number three, if someone has high cardiovascular risk, that is not only stroke but also problems with heart disease or other circulation problems, you should also try to reach a target blood pressure of less than 140 on the top number. And they concluded, parenthetically, this is not one of the big three, but they said we were not able to make recommendations for the bottom number because there is not enough high-quality evidence. Shocking, surprising. We've been treating high blood pressure since the 1960s. We still don't have that evidence, but it is difficult when you're talking about evidence treating an entire population. And we have, around 30% of U.S. adults have high blood pressure. So this is a very common condition. When you're trying to move the bar and actually save lives or extend lives and prevent these long-term complications, that takes years of study in order to make these recommendations. And so we just don't have the information we need on them. That is our sponsor, Hypertension Guidelines. When you treat high BP, remember these guidelines three. Now, we were in the middle of an exciting expose on earwax do's and don'ts in our last fractional portion. And I know many of you have already called the station trying to find out if you can speed up the banjo music and commercials and get back to those earwax guidelines. But here we are. I don't know where I'm going with this. Our last don't was don't put cotton swabs, hairpins, car keys, toothpicks, nails, paper clips, or other things in your ear. They can cause a cut in the ear canal, poke a hole in the eardrum, or hurt the hearing bones. As a matter of fact, the guidelines we are taught to give in clinic is nothing smaller than your elbow in your ear. Next up, do not use ear candles. Ear candles do not remove earwax and can cause serious damage to the ear canal and drum. I had some patients that have tried ear candles.
Yeah, I have too.
These are, they're so at nutrition stores and at general stores and things like that. And they are pretty much exactly what they are advertised to be. Candles that you light and you hold up in the ear, and the idea is the heat will melt the earwax and down it will drip. I'll tell you the other thing, Shelley. I heard a rule of thumb is that when a person gets their ear blocked with earwax, it is the up ear when they're sleeping. That is the ear that's up, because that ear is cooler. If you look at the ear that's down against the pillow, it is warmer and it would and it's closed off, so the earwax would heat up a little bit and it would drain out because it's the down ear. I will tell you that rule is almost uniformly wrong in my experience. It's almost always the down ear that's blocked. I have no idea why.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know why, at any rate, you can't heat the ear with candles. You just can't put flames near the ear, though. That's a bad idea.
Does it mention blowing smoke in the ear?
I've heard that though, right?
Yeah.
You see, I don't think it does anything.
I don't either.
Blowing smoke.
Yeah. Well, what you do, I mean, the people who smoke cigarettes, they would just get a big mouthful of smoke and just blow it in the ear, which is rather exciting and maybe sensuous, but doesn't do anything for earwax as far as I know.
I'm just letting that one be.
Rich is looking. He has this faraway, dreamy look as he thinks what it would be like to have someone blow smoke in his ears. But that's not happening on this show, buddy. Just don't even think about it. Don't ignore symptoms if home remedies are not helping. Even if they are, don't ignore symptoms. Seek medical attention if they don't go away. Don't irrigate or try earwax removing drops if you've had previous surgery or a hole in your eardrum. Again, I can't stress this enough. You do not want to get liquids back through a hole in the eardrum. This can cause a very serious infection. You can life-threatening infection. Don't do it. And don't forget to clean your hearing aids as manufacturer and your hearing health professional recommend. I got a few people that I might just send that last don't to. Got some people that don't pay much attention to me. They tend to sit in low chairs. I'm not naming names. Maybe they need to clean their hearing aids as recommended.
I don't have a hearing aid.
Maybe that's the problem.
I heard him say
it. No. You heard something about a hearing aid. Oh, I got to tell you, had a coworker. We were trying to figure out what question you ask when you want to know if a person, if it hurts when they pee, when they go to the bathroom to do number one. And the guidelines from one of the physical exam courses that I'm teaching, the textbook guidelines, said use the word urinate. And I thought, that's not a good word to use because a lot of people don't know urinate. And so one of my coworkers said that his daughter had told his mother, her grandmother, had asked her, they were in a car trip. She said, do you need to urinate And the grandmother replied, "No, I can hear just fine."
I don't believe you.
Yeah, no, that is a true story. I just heard that this week, and I tend to forget them fast, so you know that might actually have happened at one point or another. All right, Jelly, what do you know about valerian or valerian root?
Valerian, it's related to catnip. It's very malodorous.
Is it? I've never smelled it.
Yeah, it is. I use it every once in a while.
This is valerian. I've got a here on January 13th. I've got a response from a lady named Gail Scott. She's a PharmD, assistant professor in physiological sciences at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia. And they were asking if I have trouble sleeping, do you think valerian might help? It is added to tea, and it is specifically added to Sleepy Time Extra Herbal Tea by Celestial Seasonings. That's right. We are mentioning a brand name here. Now, it is not a true tea. I didn't realize that. But in order to have a tea, you have to have something that has tea leaves. But this is an herbal infusion because you basically liquefy an herb and you take it by mouth. It's supposed to promote relaxation, may help with, muscle cramps, muscle spasms, sleep disturbances, and so forth. The science, as always with herbal products, is sketchy. There was one study that showed 30% were improved with valerian root, 4% with placebo. That sounds like a pretty good sleep aid. But another showed it was no better than placebo. Maybe there's some improvement in fatigue. A third trial, no difference between it and placebo. An analysis of all the trials could not find any significant differences that were consistent across all trials. And you'll see this a lot. Now, lest people think that we are in some way condemning all herbal products, you can see similar things for sleeping pills, prescription sleeping pills. They do not work very well. Adverse effects, similar to that of placebo, some diarrhea, nausea, and it doesn't seem to cause neurologic impairment. They gave a one-time dose and didn't see anything on a driving simulator. So a lot of people use that sort of stuff, and it may be beneficial to help sleep. Now, I know you use quite a bit of melatonin in elderly people to help with sleep.
Yes.
And you have used valerian or?
I've used it personally. I've not. I don't use it with patients.
You're not recommended. What do you think about it?
I think it helps me. I'll use it rarely as a mild muscle relaxant. I'll add it to some Aleve.
Then, interesting enough, there was that recommendation on January 13th on the same day in the journal BMJ Case Reports. There was a case report of a 47-year-old woman who presented to the hospital following periods of confusion and collapsed and had a seizure. She started a variety of herbal remedies in order to do a New Year's Day detox, and that was milk thistle, mulcosam, which I don't know, I-theanine, glutamine, vitamin B compound, vervain, sage tea, green tea, and valerian root. Due to increased stress and low mood, she progressively started taking them all together. Why not? They're all herbal. What could go wrong? Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah. Well, in fact, they found that her sodium was dangerously low. It was as if she were drinking 10 liters of water a day to dilute her sodium down to that level, which led to confusion and seizures. They found one other case report. Now, they don't know which of these things caused it, but it was clear that she wasn't drinking 10 liters of water a day. Something else was going on. And there was one other case report of valerian root causing low sodium. Now, this is not to make you worried about valerian root. It's to point out that herbal products are not. They may have been around. Valerian root's been around for millennia and been reported for millennia. But you can overdose on something that's been around for millennia and get into serious problems. And in fact, that's what apparently happened to this woman. It, in general, may be of some benefit, not a whole lot of benefit for sleep. It may help with muscle relaxation, like your idea of combining it with non-steroids. Interesting idea. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of science behind this. And again, because there's no money in it, no one's going to sit down and do a six-month or one-year study of long-term impact of valerian root. It's not going to happen. You're going to have to make a decision. In all of these things, you use caution, and you shouldn't be combining a bunch of different products, be they medical, be they herbal. I can't tell you, and Shelley, you have seen it as well as I have, how many people get into trouble by combining medicines, herbal products, medicines and herbal products, crossing over different things. Quite simply, there are risks with all of these products, whether they're herbal or medicine.
Yeah, I think very few herbals are safe to take when you have a lot of prescription medication that you take daily.
Yeah, and they do interact. Things that you put in your system do interact. They compete for the enzymes that metabolize them. They can lead to high levels. They can build up the enzymes and lead to low levels. These are things, if tell your doctor, but I will tell you, and this is no knock against practicing physicians, many practicing physicians, the information is just simply not available, the type of interactions we're talking about. And so the other thing is use caution, and you certainly should not be combining all those. My rule of thumb is one medicine at a time. I will not change more than one medicine at a time, occasionally two if I'm in a real dire situation. But in an outpatient situation, you have time to work on this. The other thing we should mention again, and we heard this from Dr. Barb Phillips back in December, is that cognitive behavioral therapy, if you're having difficulty sleeping, is the place you should start and probably the only thing you should do. It is available. There are apps to try to help you through this. It is changing your sleep behaviors so that you make it so that you're able to sleep rather than trying to drug your brain or render yourself unconscious with drugs or herbal products, a much better way to go. Now, temporarily, there are cases that come up. We have that all the time in the hospital where you're not able to make things optimal for sleep, and you may need to use something temporarily. But long term, the best thing to do for sleep difficulties is to make changes in your behavior. And as we said, you know, the screen time is one thing that you can do. The other things are to try to create a restful environment and try to eliminate distractions. That's a lot. You're less likely to seize that way anyway. Next up, January 12th, Washington Post. New study from the CDC. Rural Americans more likely to die from heart disease, cancer, and the three other leading causes of death than their urban counterparts. Any surprise on that?
No.
We've made a living of this at 14 years talking about that.
Yeah, you know, the CDC says, well, it's a combination of economics, of lifestyle, of dietary choices, and of access to healthcare facilities. But there it is. There is that difference, and we feel that that difference was one of the many things that drove some of the elections, the disparity between urban and rural. We happen to be living in a rural area. We happen to be living this particular problem, and you can see where something might be very simple to do in an urban area, access to medical care, access to good foods, access to safe places to exercise, it becomes darn near impossible in a rural area. Top five causes of death, heart disease, cancer, unintentional injury, that includes drug overdoses, car crashes, and so forth, and chronic lower respiratory disease and stroke, 62% of the total 1.6 million deaths in the U.S. in 2014. And it takes them a while to put all these numbers together. That's why we're talking about something from a little bit over 2 years ago. Among rural Americans, more than 70,000 deaths were potentially preventable, including 25,000 from heart disease and 19,000 from cancer. And what we've seen is studies that indicate if we simply had the access to the resources and the lifestyle of people in wealthier areas and more urban areas, huge numbers, thousands of deaths could be prevented. Now, getting that access, that's a whole different matter.
Yeah.
50% of the U.S. population lives in rural areas. That's 46 million people. Older, poorer, sicker than urban Americans, higher rates of cigarette smoking, high blood pressure and obesity, lower rates of physical activity, don't use seatbelts as often, less access to health care, less likely to have insurance. Could there be anything more direct than that? This is a problem. You know, and I got to say, this is where maybe I'm not a Republican. If
I thought you said we were all Republicans.
Well, we are certainly all waving the Republican flag.
But you just said you weren't.
I said I might not be.
So you wave it at a different beat than everybody else.
I don't wave it. No, I guess I do wave it as high because from where you're starting, you wouldn't wave your flag
I'm
as high.
I'm taller than you.
Yeah, you used to be, yes, before
and
you
I
got
can
that
make,
chair.
I can make up for that height even in this low chair.
Shelly, why don't you just stay where
you are. You know, it shouldn't be the 6 foot two you should worry about. It should be the 275 pounds.
All right. Back to the Republicans, though. I don't know. These vague threats. This doesn't accomplish anything
was
on a radio
vague?
Show. You know.
I thought
these
I was doing a better job
explicit
than that.
Threats. You know, but I feel that if you look at the role of government, one of the roles of government is to provide for the safety of its citizens. Now, you know, this might be through an armed military, it might be through police force, fire protection, and so forth. But the other thing is, when there are these behaviors that threaten the lives of people, obviously no one chooses to set their house on fire and I mean, obviously they're arsonists, but follow me here. No one chooses to set their house on fire. The problem with dietary changes as opposed to setting your house on fire is you don't see the results quite so rapidly. But the decision is equally destructive. I mean, dead is dead, whether it's dead of heart attack or dead of a house fire. And we do so much work to try to protect people from sudden death, house fires, shootings, robbery, and things. And yet those slow causes of death, we don't do anything about. Had a patient. He smoked heavily, and he had some difficulty with sleep apnea. We didn't know what it was back then when I was treating him. And he was blue, purple, kind of all the time because he had low oxygen levels. And he would try to commit suicide. So we would put him in the hospital for trying to commit suicide, and while he was in the hospital, he would just smoke away. He was, in fact, committing suicide, but just on an acceptably slow pace rather than trying to do it all of a sudden with a drug overdose or something like that. That's, the problem is, again, whether this is fast or slow, these things do happen. And in my mind, the government must look at both fast causes of death and slow causes of death and try to have an equal measured response if we're protecting our citizens. But that makes it more difficult because a lot of this stuff is statistical. I'm saying we should tax soft drinks that have sugar in them. I'm saying that we should have smoking bans and tax cigarettes. We should try to modify people's behavior and get rid of this self-destructive stuff.
So where does that end, though? You're absolutely right. You've left the Republican ranks, and you know, are we supposed to? Are you going to start taxing me for sitting on my couch? For if I own a recliner, should I have to pay a tax because you know that is kind of lazy? Where does it end, Tony? Where does it begin?
Well, it begins with the things that we know work to produce better behaviors.
Isn't there? I mean, but there's probably other ways to attack the slow things.
Yeah.
I think, you know, sugar, okay, great. But, you know, sugar is only part of the problem. My laziness is the other part.
Yeah.
And believe me, look at me. I've got lots of laziness.
And being a UK employee, I know
need
that
some
there
of it
are some
right now.
Financial incentives.
Right.
To do something.
You
need something right now. I heard you. So what we're going to do right now is take a break. We're all going to get up and run around the studio, slapping ourselves silly.
Yeah.
And then why don't you do the same at home and come back for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the It's Trump and Bevin in 2017 show. Our salute to Republicans, and Rick and I got into a significant Republican debate while slapping each other silly during the break. Red-faced.
I won.
The man has a mean slap. I'll give you that, especially coming from that low chair. He kind of caught me off guard. Our sponsor, before we renew the debate, is the Hypertension Guidelines. This comes from the American College of Physicians, the American Academy of Family Physicians. And our motto, when you try to treat your high BP, remember these guidelines. There were three things that they mentioned, and these are extremely simple guidelines as far as treating blood pressure in people over age 60. Based on a review of 21 randomized controlled trials, three observational studies looked at the benefits and harms of higher versus lower blood pressure goals for the treatment of high blood pressure in older adults. These trials looked at all-cause mortality, stroke, cardiac events, heart attacks, sudden cardiac death, and combined, they have these three recommendations. Recommendation number one, initiate treatment in older patients with persistent blood pressures top number above 150. If your top number is persistently above 150, you need to have treatment initiated. Now, I will tell you, most physicians, most recommendations use the number 140 or above. They said, well, people age 60 or older, 150 or above is their recommendation. I will also tell you there are already dissenting groups saying you should treat older adults as aggressively as it will allow. If they get dizzy, then you have to back down. But if they don't get dizzy when they stand up and they're able to walk, you should go for a lower target. That actually will save older people's lives. These people are not convinced. Again, they feel that the trials that showed that were very selective in the older adults that they enrolled, and they did not enroll older, sicker patients, and so it's not valid. So the argument goes back and forth. Second one, consider initiating or intensifying treatment in older patients with a history of stroke to reach a target blood pressure of less than 140, which is where we would go for most patients anyway, and then consider initiating or intensifying treatment in older patients with heart disease to risk a target of less than 140. So in general, you start in a person over age 60. When the blood pressure is consistently over 150, your target is 140 or less, says this guideline. And as I said, there are many, many people who would treat with a blood pressure over 140. They have valid reasons. There is an argument over the science, and this will play itself out. We want to make our listeners aware of both the numbers and also the debate over what the targets and the starting points are for blood pressure. And then the final thing, as we mentioned, recommendations for the lower number, the diastolic blood pressure target, were not made because there is not enough evidence. It turns out the bottom number is more important when you are young, but as you get older, particularly over age 60, the top number is the one that chiefly determines your risk of stroke and heart attack. And much of the gains in the past 30 years were because we recognized the top number. When I got out of medical school back during the era of the steam engine, we didn't pay any attention at all to the top number. If your bottom number was okay, we guessed that, well, you must have a really vigorous heart to get that top number. Good for you. And it turned out that was among the many things that were wrong with my medical education, was that we had no idea that the top number even mattered. Now we know it does, in fact, more so than the bottom number. Now let's go back for a minute. We were talking about the plight of rural America, the problems they have with the fact that of the major causes of death, the top five, that they take these top five causes of death, more than 60% of the total deaths in the United States come from cancer, heart disease, injuries, that includes drug overdoses and accidents, chronic lower respiratory disease, that's emphysema, bronchitis, and stroke. Those five things, 62% of total deaths, and rural Americans much more likely to die from heart disease, cancer, and the others than urban Americans. And in fact, the life expectancy, even in the state of Kentucky, the life expectancy drops 10 years when you go from Fayette County to Wolf County, an hour's drive or less. Going from urban Kentucky to rural Kentucky, life expectancies drop rapidly. Part of it is the narcotics that wash through eastern Kentucky, so there are people dying at a very young age, and that lowers your life expectancy. But part of it is, quite simply, the access to medical care, the economics, and the habits of people. I made the comment, and we're talking about, again, we're all Republicans now because we have...
Well, no, you basically stood up and said, well, you're not a Republican at some time.
We have, in the state of Kentucky, a Republican Senate, a Republican House, and a Republican governor. The chances, then, of either at a national level or a state level, and Republicans are for minimal government. So the idea that we might be able to get our cigarette tax up and prevent 3,500 Kentuckians from dying of lung cancer, the fact that we might be able to initiate taxes on sugary soft drinks, which in Mexico and in California has been shown to reduce rates of diabetes and reduce rates of consumption of these, there is no chance for that. Even though from a revenue standpoint, they are at worst neutral and they may create some additional revenues. The no new taxes includes taxes that might have some health benefit. So Rick says to me, I said, look, this is what I would use government for, not just to protect us from sudden causes of death like fire and a hail of gunfire and all that stuff, but also to protect us from the slow deaths that happen because of our diet, because of our exercise, because of our habits, and because of our lack of access to medical care. I would use government for that. Rick says, where do you stop? And specifically, you mentioned activity. Now, I know as an employee of UK, there are incentives for you to be more active. The UK will periodically put out these things. You think then, in a very Republican fashion, that this stuff should be left to the private sector. There should be incentives on soft drinks. There should be incentives on physical activity.
No, Tony, I don't think that. I think, you know, the problem is when you put a tax on tacos or you put a tax on sugar or you put a tax on something that one person or maybe a group of people, I mean, I'm not going to say that it's not accurate, but still, it's another group, one group of people determining that this particular thing is causing the actual slow death when really it comes down to a combination of things, right? We've seen people that, I mean, you know as much as anybody, I don't like smoking. I think it's bad. I think that people should not smoke. That being said, My grandfather smoked until he was 99 years old. Genetically, he was okay with smoking. So he was a rare individual, right? So there are people that can drink. I see people at work, they drink soda all the time. They don't get heavy. I don't know if that's because they're exercising or what, but their metabolism somehow or another seems to deal with the amount of food or the type of food that they eat. So not everybody is a cookie cutter, right? And things are different things. So to just say, okay, sugar is bad and we're going to tax it, well, that's not really taking the people that just sit on the couch or don't exercise or don't express, you know, to me, and this is where sometimes the Republican viewpoint goes off the rails, is I think, you know, it comes down to personal choice, personal freedoms, being able to manage my own personal responsibilities. Now, have I done a great job? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not.
By the way, Rick looks exceptionally good as I look down on him today from my high chair. He is looking sharp today. Yeah. He has lost some weight. He looks very good.
So all I'm saying is to try to just broad, you know, a broad sweeping, okay, we're going to tax this or we're going to do that may not be the solution. I mean, frankly, it's a complex problem, and no one-hour health show as bad as ours is going to solve this. We can talk about it.
Yeah. Now,
but I'm just saying, to me, there's a hard. Where do you draw the line? Where do you say, okay, well, if we're going to tax sugar, why not tax tacos? Why not tax? You know, why don't we go for the yogurt companies? Because, you know, let's be honest, yogurt's pretty. I mean, you may say it's good for you, but if you eat a gallon of it, it's probably not good for you.
Right.
So should they be taxed too?
My problem is, in this country, we allow these companies to advertise to children and to insert their products into the school systems.
I think that's a different topic than taxes.
Okay. I'm saying if they in fact, and there are some theories right now that sugar has everything that an addictive substance would have. Sugar, in fact, does go to your brain. We know there are places in the reward center, just like drugs, where sugar goes. The levels rise very rapidly after you consume sugar. So if you take a sugar load, it's going to make you feel really good. It has some properties that are consistent with addictive substances. The idea of a sugary drink being addictive, you know, we sort of pass that off.
So how many times have we talked about diet soda being just as bad?
Yeah.
But it doesn't have any sugar in it, so it wouldn't be subject to the same tax. Still bad for you. Still probably contributes to your weight gain.
Right.
Because it readjusts your sweet level.
It readjusts your sweet level, and it may actually have some effects on your gut flora. Put it this way, at the very minimum, and I'm going to science now, Rick. I'm thinking about how I'm going to smack you down with a good answer. In the meantime, we'll go to science and say that diet sodas collectively have done nothing to help us lose weight.
Sure.
That's pretty clear. You go from high calorie, you saved 250, 300 calories per soda, and yet it doesn't seem to matter. So
yeah, we're going to tax the ones with sugar in them. See, that's where my Republican lines go. Why? Why would we do that? Let's figure out a different thing. We talked about it in the break. Maybe we've been so dead set on getting rid of the arts in schools. Maybe we've been so dead set on basic STEM and basic, you know, you can only go to school to learn math. You can't learn arts. You can't learn life. You can't learn how to cook. You can't learn how to, you know, work on a car pretty much anymore. I mean, there's so many things we're trying to focus on. Maybe we've been focusing on the wrong things. Maybe we need to just go back and rethink that. Now, again, I don't know what the solution is. I'm just here to make good, you know.
Well, and your point is the solution is going to be different for different socioeconomic groups. I have a problem with people who get incensed about motorcycle helmets but not about ski helmets.
Right.
Because, it is very much a class thing. If you're a lower middle class person, you like motorcycles and you like riding without a helmet to feel free. If you are an upper middle class person, you like skiing and you don't want a helmet while you're skiing.
Here's what I believe a Republican view might be on motorcycle helmets. I don't care if you wear a helmet or not. I don't care. But if you're in a car, if you're in a motorcycle accident and you need government paid for health care, you have null and voided that contract. I should not have to pay for your health care if you've chosen not to wear a helmet.
Oh, great. Now, Rick, see, this was a weak argument. he's exposed himself. Because I'm going to say, oh, so you think helmets for, you should avoid your insurance if you wear a helmet while riding a motorcycle, which is a lower socioeconomic thing to do. But you're not going to get into bicycle helmets, ski helmets, and other helmets.
No,
how many helmets are you going to tax, Rick? How many helmets are you going to tax?
How many seatbelts? You can go there. You should have went seatbelts, because seatbelts are the same thing. If you're not wearing a seatbelt in the car, you probably shouldn't get government health care.
Oh, but a motorcycle doesn't have seatbelts, so therefore.
I'm saying when you negate a defined safety mechanism that is required by law, you shouldn't get health care for it. I shouldn't have to pay for it.
Well, but I'm going to be compelled to provide your health care. So what you're saying is I need to donate my health care services for people who do not follow the law. Because, you know, and by the way,
we're doing this in fun.
Yeah, we are.
We're
and the other thing is we both know, as with a broad brush, it is impossible to avoid hypocrisy here. That is, you cannot have a uniform approach
exactly.
that works in all these circumstances. So the question is, if you cannot, and let me just jump ahead here, if you can't have a uniform approach, then if you know something like sugary soft drinks leads to higher rates of diabetes, well, at least to higher rates of diabetes in the population. Yeah, there were some that do, some that don't. But enough do that it puts a burden on our healthcare system. Then should we pick off a few of those behaviors? Should we allow the upper class to determine what the lower class does? Should there be participatory democracy here? And all of us decide it. What do we do? But there are a number of cities, most of them Democratic, that in fact have instituted these taxes and appear to be on their way to lowering the rates of diabetes.
You don't have the statistics in front of you, so I don't expect you to answer this. But how many cities in the U.S. over the population of 1 million do you think went Republican? I'm going to guess zero.
I would say Republican.
So basically what you're saying is urban areas in general above 1 million – are trying to look at. I mean, that's where this is going to have some ability to get passed.
Can I play devil's advocate?
No,
for a
but
minute?
Go ahead.
No,
but go ahead.
I think what we run into here is individual rights versus population. So if we look at the cost to the population of high sugar consumption or cigarette smoking, I think that's the approach we need to take.
We've not made that link, though. That this is the thing. For instance, in the case of cigarettes, it's very clear this is a cause of premature death. Now, cost, it has saved our pension system. I mean, our pension system in Kentucky is in bad shape, even with heavy smoking thinning out the ranks of pensioners. If we did not have smoking, then we would have so many more people on pensions that it would have gone under much earlier. So even with that, you can't say that smoking is necessarily bad financially for the state of Kentucky. It has its pluses and its minuses. So this your argument is really tough.
Well, and the same argument holds true for the motorcycle accidents, because they tend not to live, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so they're not really a burden on the healthcare system. They're not in, you know, so.
No, I think that obviously individuals are, and there's a.
Yeah, right.
But I would say as a class, you're right. And as a matter of fact, and pardon me for being morbid, organ donors, many of them come from motorcycles as opposed to the skiers, because the motorcycle people are closer to the road where they're able to get access.
But there's a good joke
care.
There. I'm just going to leave it be, though. It's probably not the time or the place.
No. But you're right in terms of what they do for society or do to society. It's interesting, Rick, though, you mentioned if the Republican Party is, in fact, the party of rural areas, shouldn't the Republican Party be concerned about these urban-rural health differences? And I have certainly they have no.
It is weird. It is very conflicting.
Yeah, if we are their constituents, then shouldn't they be concerned about our health?
They should. But the funny thing is there's just other things they're concerned with as well that fly in the face of it. It's the capitalism thing. It's a tough conversation.
It is, and if you are a party of minimal government, then you may be concerned, but you are looking for private sector solutions.
Yeah, you would argue that a party of minimal government isn't worried about increasing the age of its population. It's only making sure its quality of life is okay.
I got to
think
about that.
Now, leave on that one.
You want to end on that? You think that's a...
No, I don't. But I think we've got like 27 minutes more of stuff and like 30 seconds to put it in there.
We could at least sing God Bless America or do something to demonstrate kind of an uplifting... Rick, get us off the air. I'm too upset to talk.
Boy, I'm glad to be of service. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilber, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show and stay tuned for this important safety information.
Health Matters is a once weekly prescription radio show that, along with diet and exercise, helps lower blood sugar levels in adults with type 2 diabetes.
Health Matters should not be heard by patients with type 1 diabetes or with diabetic ketoacidosis. If you have pancreatitis, if you've had pancreatitis, it is not known if you have a high chance of getting it while listening to our show.
Do not listen to our show if you are allergic to any of its ingredients, including Shelley Irvin. Symptoms of serious allergic reactions, including rash, hives, and swelling of the face, lips, tongue, and throat, may cause difficulty breathing or swallowing. If you have any symptoms of a serious allergic reaction, turn off your radio and call your doctor right away.
Serious side effects can happen in people who listen to Health Matters, including pancreatitis, which may be severe and lead to death.
Kidney problems, sometimes requiring dialysis, have been reported. Some people who listen to health radio shows may develop joint pain and can be severe. Call your doctor if you have a severe joint pain.
Sure, call them up. If you listen to Health Matters with another radio show that can cause low blood sugar, your risk of getting low blood sugar is higher. The dose of the other show may need to be lowered while you listen to Health Matters. Signs and symptoms of low blood sugar include headache, drowsiness, weakness, dizziness, confusion, irritability, hunger, fast talking, fast heartbeat, sweating, and feeling jittery.
Your doctor may do blood tests before and during our show to see how well your kidneys are working.
That's
based
important.
On these results, your doctor may change your dose of Health Matters. Hopefully they will. The most common side effects of Health Matters are stuffy or runny nose and sore throat and general sense of disgust.
Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week. Make a healthy change in your life. And tune in next week as Shelley discusses hyperglycemia, which is just the sweetest thing you've ever heard, on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.